Whoa, Betsy.
Oh. Hot diggity dog, we've got a podcast to do. Howdy, folks. All right, that's enough of the horse stuff. I'm good. I think we've had our fill. So welcome back for the horse episode number 2. You probably all thought, okay, like, we did the weird episode name. Been there, done that, check that off. Why on earth are they doing horse episode part 2? There's got to be a story behind this. And there is. And I will share the framework for this one first, instead of revealing the reason for the title towards the end of the episode like we did before. Probably everybody is familiar with the expression, and I'm going to butcher it, but like, you'll get the gist of it. When you hear hooves, first look for horses, not for zebras, right? Like, we've all heard some variant of that expression. And what it's meant to mean is that you look for the most obvious or the most common cause of illness first or symptom first. You don't just jump from like, oh, I have a 1 out of 10 dull headache. Is it dehydration or is it cancer? Right? Like, you don't make that jump. But I felt like this was a worthy topic to cover because we were talking recently. And I do think that sometimes the people that we've worked with, and probably a lot of our listeners, can get in this position where, whether they realize it or not, they are thinking everything is a zebra and they're ignoring the possible horses in their health journey. So that's like the basic framework of why we named this one the horse episode part 2. Cowgirl, have you anything to say to start us off?
Yeah.
I'm going to call you cowgirl for the rest of the episode, for the record. Oh, it's going to be great.
For the record, that was hard for me to do. That went outside of my comfort zone. But I pushed myself. And now I feel like I've had personal growth. I've had some personal growth through the welcome intro. Okay, yes.
I think we also proved, like, maybe I'm a little bit more... I'm either weirder than you or I'm more open with my weirdness than you, perhaps. Or maybe I'm just more extroverted than you.
Oh my gosh.
Some combination thereof.
But I did it, and I'm proud of myself.
I'm proud of you, too.
Anyway, I think this is a really interesting area, I think, for both SIBO and IBS, because, you know, I would say in my experience working with people, you know, you have someone that comes with SIBO, and it's like, my energy's low because of SIBO. I have headaches because of SIBO. You know, I have low libido because of SIBO. I have this because of SIBO. Like, everything boils down to SIBO or gut imbalance or the gut dysfunction. When, again, you have to focus in on other potential factors. And again, mm-hmm. typically when I work with people, usually because they've just had a bunch of testing probably prior to working with me, sometimes I don't even test until a little bit later on, till we've worked on some foundational pieces, because usually there's some obvious factors that they're missing. But I think, again, you can get blinded by the SIBO diagnosis or the IBS diagnosis because you'll see these symptoms that could be connected to these issues. And it's like, well, no, maybe your low energy is that you're not getting enough protein and your blood sugar's swinging throughout the day. And your headaches could be some electrolyte issues.
Or you're just dehydrated and you're not good right. about drinking enough water through the day.
Right. Or you're dehydrated. Maybe, again, your low libido is because you're so stressed trying to manage the SIBO situation. Yeah. So I do think that it's super, super common to get really in the weeds at times with kind of a particular diagnosis or issue and start linking it to everything. And it can get you into a lot of trouble and prevent progress because you're just missing what you're saying, the obvious things. Yeah. I think it's a really common problem in the IBS and SIBO population.
And I will add, it's pretty common in other populations too. Like,
right.
I've seen this with people with autoimmune diseases, like, oh, this and this and this are because of my Hashimoto's or because of my autoimmunity. And I think, you know, it's not to say that things can't be connected in surprising ways.
Right.
Once again, I want to point out, and I think you're in line with me on this too, there's a spectrum. And once again, Amy and I are finding ourselves in the middle of the spectrum, seeing both sides of the story. Whereas, and I'll paint an example that is the opposite of this entire conversation to kind of prove the point. I worked with a guy. He was having angina, chest pain. Young guy, you know, 34, 35, something when he worked with me. Young guy, healthy, like exercised, etc. He ate pretty clean. And he was getting angina, chest pain. And he went to the cardiologist. And when he went to the cardiologist, he actually told them, hey, by the way, when I get the angina, it always correlates with when my IBS flares up and gets really, really bad. And I think that they're related. And the cardiologist, shocker of all shockers, was like, eh, no, they're not. Psh, whatever. And they just like wrote it off and they were like, no, it's not connected. Get out of here. And they basically were like, yeah, we can't really find anything wrong, like structurally or right. electrically with your heart. So we don't know what's going on. Eh, like, good luck. And they sent him packing. And luckily, he knew enough to think that that was not purely coincidental. So he reached out to me, and I think I might have told the story even before. Among several of the tests that we ended up running on him, we ran C-reactive protein, which is correlated with risk of future heart attack or stroke, right? It's not even made in the heart. It's actually made in the liver, but it is correlated with, like, the higher it is, the higher your risk of a heart attack or stroke. The normal range is like 0.5 to 3.0, basically, from LabCorp's ranges, at least. His was 97.
Oh my gosh.
97. I did not know it went that high. Like, that just took the cake. And, you know, here he is, like, this mid-30s, reasonably healthy otherwise guy. He was doing low FODMAP to manage his IBS. And he felt like garbage, but, like, you would look at him and think, oh, he's pretty healthy. And a lot of his other labs looked fine, but here he was with angina that flared at the same time as his IBS. His C-reactive protein was through the roof. And I'll tell you, 6 weeks later, we did a really intensive protocol for, like, SIBO and leaky gut, because it turned out he had both. Oh, side note, his IBS really went through the roof when he and his wife went to Thailand, and they both got food poisoning. Mm. So we confirmed post-infectious IBS. He had the anti-vinculin antibodies. We did this whole big SIBO protocol, leaky gut protocol. 6 weeks later, we rechecked C-reactive protein. It was 0.97.
Oh my
and
gosh.
The angina was totally gone. And I don't tell you that story just because it's like a really wild story, but because there can be symptoms that are related to your gut that would genuinely surprise you and shock you. I just talked to somebody today and she said that her brain fog got substantially better when she worked on her gut. She had had gut problems for a long time, didn't realize it. She worked on cleaning up her gut and her brain fog was a heck of a lot better. But what we're kind of harping on here, not harping, but what we're kind of railing against a little bit is this idea that you can blame all of your woes on SIBO or leaky gut or candida or whatever it might be. And it might be that you genuinely have several things going on that all are interrelated. Like, if you're fatigued and brain fogged because you're iron deficient, guess what? That's going to disrupt your motility and that's going to make the SIBO worse for you and the low stomach acid worse. So the two of them could be correlated, but not in the sense that the SIBO is causing the brain fog necessarily. Like, it could be an indirect linkage that, like, the root cause of both goes back to some other, you know, deficiency or insufficiency or inflammatory source. But yeah, I see that pretty commonly, that people assume that it goes back to the gut. And God love the internet and the functional medicine community. I blame both the internet at large and functional medicine and, like, naturopathic medicine, because you hear this all day, every day. When in doubt, start with the gut. Or no matter what condition you have, start with the gut first. And it's like, eh, I don't, I mean, maybe I get why people say that, but I think it's more nuanced than that. But you hear this kind of repetitive story of like, always start with the gut. All disease starts in the gut. That's like a naturopathic thing they talk about. Like, everything starts in the gut. Always start with the gut. You have to have a clean gut. That's the foundation for everything. Yada, yada, yada. That plus, you know, the influencers selling you fancy schmancy probiotics or elemental heal. And you start getting paranoid thinking that literally everything is connected to your gut, when in actuality, some of it might not be. Not directly, at least.
Yeah, I think another common one that I see people really heavily blaming gut, and I think, again, there's a huge connection here, and we've definitely talked about this, but it's like the whole mental health kind of side mm-hmm. of the equation, too, is really common for this, where, yeah. you know, I have clients where it's like, oh, my mental health won't get better until my gut gets better. Yeah. And it's like I've seen that in some cases, again, to your point, like I've definitely seen a few cases where like they didn't have any anxiety issues and then they had a food poisoning event and it's like, whoa, their anxiety, they just, yeah. anxiety came out of nowhere. And there's other cases where someone's kind of been more on the anxious spectrum, probably locked in fight or flight for their whole life, maybe had some trauma. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, no, it's my gut. And they get so hyper-focused on the gut piece that they don't yeah. work on the nervous system side of the equation. So I think that's another really common example that I see a lot where, you know, you'll have people hyper-focused on one side of the equation when, again, maybe yeah. some general strategies into both might be helpful. Maybe one side, again, maybe working on the trauma side is going to be more helpful if you have yeah. more of that going on in your equation versus the person that got major anxiety post food poisoning incident might benefit a little bit more from doing a little bit more gut work. So yeah, I think that's another really common example that I see.
That honestly, I think like anxiety, depression, brain fog, fatigue probably make up the big four that people equate with, oh, this must be the gut. I guess joint pain too and skin stuff. Yeah. But and I have seen a lot of people where they are. It's almost like you kind of give yourself permission to not address the mental health side directly, because it's like you're putting all the eggs in the one basket of the gut health, and like, oh, I don't have to do the shitty hard work of going to therapy and working through my trauma and finding a therapist that I like and doing, you know, doing the things like reducing my stress at home or at work and like setting boundaries. Like, all of that stuff is really hard and nobody wants to do it. All the stuff that actually affects our mental health, nobody wants to go there. And right. it's almost like if you could use the gut as a scapegoat and be like, oh, convenient, I don't have to do any of that mental health garbage stuff that I don't want to do, and I could give myself permission to avoid it if I just blame it all on the gut. I think that's a piece of it, because anything that's related to stress and mental health is probably going to be really just daunting to go through. And right. I'm right there. Like I've said many times on this podcast, my pattern all my life, I think, has been to take any stress or anxiety and just like shove it down deep, rid of it, because it's icky. I don't want to deal with it. And that only works up to a certain point. But I will say I've seen both directions. Again, it's a two-way street. Right. So sometimes that common assumption is true. I remember I saw a lady, well, maybe she's a bad example, but I remember I saw this woman, she had like 10 out of 10 anxiety. She right. barely made it to my office to have an appointment with me, actually. And she cried several times at our appointment. And I'm like not a scary, intimidating person, I hope. And her husband said she had not left the house at all for like 3 months because she was terrified to go anywhere. Like she couldn't work, she couldn't grocery shop, she couldn't go anywhere. And it all started when her IBS started. Right. And for her, I don't know if I told you about this one, the triggering event for her was pretty unique. She took a high dose of a PPI for a month. I forget what it was, like 40 milligrams or something. Like it was higher than the standard 20 milligram kind of dose. It might have been 40 or 80. But she took a high dose of a PPI for a month with extra strength Claritin. And the reason for it was she said that they were trying to have a baby and they weren't having any luck having a baby. But she read online that if you take 1 month of like high dose Claritin and high dose, you know, Nexium or something, that you would get pregnant. And so that it didn't happen. Spoiler alert, it didn't work. I don't know how it would ever work. I don't understand the mechanism of that at all. But she tried that for a month or maybe two, didn't get pregnant. And then she was like, okay, well, it's not working. So she discontinued both of them cold turkey, got wicked, wicked rebound reflux.
Right.
Because, you know, she was just doing this on her own, not prescribed. Nobody counseled her. She got really bad rebound reflux. And then she had to go back on like a low dose of the PPI. But it was basically like during the course of that whole kerfuffle that her IBS started. And I still remember, like, again, like she was really not able to like participate in normal day-to-day life. And I remember I started her on just like one antimicrobial because I was like, we've got to work on something in the interim before we even get testing back in because like you're in such rough shape. And I remember like even doing that one thing, her husband emailed me and said like she was actually going out to the grocery store. She had checked out like a co-working space. This was pre-pandemic, obviously, but she had like gone a couple of times to a co-working place and she had worked like on her computer at a co-working station and she was out and about quite a bit more. And you know, it's like, I think that she probably had some stress and some trauma. If nothing else, difficulty conceiving. Like that's right. Traumatic AF, right? But so it's not to say she had zero pre-existing anxiety or stress, but it just like reared its ugly head out of freaking nowhere. Mm-hmm. And just starting to get that gut a little bit better did drastically reduce her anxiety so that she was able to go out in the world. But I've seen many more people where they think that's going to happen and it doesn't. And then they're left kind of scratching their heads. And then they think they have the world's worst case of SIBO and the world's most stubborn case of SIBO. And it's actually the anxiety and the stress level frying their vagus nerve and keeping them stuck in the SIBO land. So treating the stress or treating the anxiety ends up being the most impactful thing for more people than not. Like if you have SIBO and you have a lot of stress and you have some degree of anxiety, I would say there's like an 80-20 percentage. I would say 80% chance you need to treat the mental health stuff in order to treat the SIBO. 20% chance you treat the SIBO and it magically goes away. That's kind of the ratio I've seen at least.
Yeah. And again, I would typically say that, you know, it doesn't hurt to do things on both sides of the aisle either. So
yeah.
You know, doing things that are generally supportive of stress management is going to be build resilience in general for your health and be important in potentially other areas, even outside of mental health and other areas outside of will help digestion. And again, it'll just have a lot of positive effects. It's a basic foundational piece of the puzzle. Yeah. And doing those stress management things should be helpful for mental health stuff. You might need to go above and beyond if there's trauma in doing like therapy and more intensive based stuff. But I also think, again, like you could support both sides of the equation. It's not like you have to choose one or the other. You might have to go a little bit harder into one side of the equation compared to the other. But yeah, I think that's a good example. And I will say, too, I like that you brought up some of the other kind of symptoms that are generally associated with gut issues. Fatigue is a really big one that I see often. And again, I would say fatigue just has so many different potential causes. I mean, there could be hormonal things. I think there's a lot of dietary problems that I see driving. Like, first and foremost, I would look at nutrition if you're having energy issues. So making sure you're getting enough to eat, looking for nutrient deficiencies, like things like iron, I know you had mentioned, or B12 deficiencies. Yeah. Some of the common ones that we see in our population of patients. So looking for those things, I think, would be really important. I also think with fatigue, looking for anything blood sugar related, which can go along with nutrition, but making sure things are balanced. Again,
sleep. Like, are you getting garbage sleep?
Right. But, and I think, again, like, once you sort of covered the foundational bases, which most people don't, that's, like, the hardest thing, I think, that goes along with this. It's, to me, again, some of the obvious things are not necessarily easy, like what you're describing with addressing stress. Yeah. When the full focus of most of the nutrition advice in the SIBO space is just remove these foods and you'll be good to go, or, you know, that it'll take care of your symptoms. That's a very, like, it might be hard to do just because it's restrictive, but it's pretty straightforward. And nutrition, again, in terms of optimizing, I don't think it has to be overly complicated, but there's just not enough focus on actually nourishing and making sure you're executing a diet that's giving you what you need. And it sounds basic, but a lot of people are not covering that base. So again, first and foremost, you got to cover some of these bases. And you might think that you are because you're doing a restrictive diet, but if you're not getting what you need, again, it could lead to things like fatigue and fog and blood sugar instability and some of these things that we see that are super common and that oftentimes will lead people down the wrong rabbit holes. They might even be like, oh, I need to remove more foods because I'm having energy issues and it's the SIBO. And so, again, well, it's just
food sensitivity. The food is making me, you know, right. And again, like, it's not to say that weird shit can't happen when you adjust a food that your body doesn't like. Like, I had 5 years of chronic low back pain that, surprise, it turns out it was just gluten. And my body hates gluten and it turns out I'm a celiac. So, like, it's not to say that your symptoms can't surprise you, but like perpetually removing foods, A, is going to get you limited benefit, first of all, like limited reward the more you do that. And B, it does set the stage for more nutritional deficiencies and inadequacies. And if you're not, it's almost analogous. Maybe this would be easier to wrap the head around. Because, like, a lot of people might not, it might not click as much just hearing us talk about, like, you need to eat enough calories. We say it every episode, people. Like, you should get this by now. But I'll share a different variation of the same thing. All right, Amy, right now you just decide that your life's calling is to run marathons. And you're going to run a marathon tomorrow. Would you eat the same amount of food you ate today? No. You would eat a lot more food, I hope. I mean, I don't recommend doing this as an exercise science bachelor's degree holder. I will say, please, for the love of God, don't just run a marathon overnight without training. But, you know, it's like if you're making extra demands on your body, you need to fuel it more. And we covered this in the episode with Kaylee recently, right? Like, healing is metabolically intensive. You need a lot of energy and protein and vitamins and minerals to fuel that process. So it's almost analogous to deciding that you're going to train for a marathon, but you're not going to feed your body enough. Like, no athlete would ever do that, I hope. And they would understand that you, like, need to be mindful of your macros and get vitamins and like, that's going to impact your recovery. But if you think, if you start training for a marathon tomorrow and you do not increase your calorie intake, what's going to happen? You're going to be more prone to injuries and, like, weird fractures, weird sprains and strains. You're going to be really fatigued and feel worn out and maybe a little bit brain foggy, and your joints and your muscles are probably going to be really mad at you. It's going to take way longer to recover from exercise. Like, a normal person might have delayed onset muscle soreness for 2 days after a hard workout. You might have DOMS, as it's called. You might have DOMS for a week after that bout of exercise, and even if you're in relatively good shape. And it's like, your body is having a hard time keeping up. and replenishing itself and fueling itself. And the same thing happens with chronic illness. We have the fatigue, the lethargy, the brain fog, the aches and pains, the feeling like, oh, my body's just not keeping up. And yet there's so many people who aren't nourishing their bodies and getting the calories and the macros that they need. And it's just like a really low-hanging fruit to and you don't even need to work with somebody like us. Don't pay us money. Like, you download Chronometer right now, or MyFitnessPal or something like that. Do a couple days of food tracking. It is so accessible now, people, that you could do this on your own and at least get that much squared away before you spend money on an expensive supplement or a lab test or professional help with one of us. Like, and it's not to say we're not both wonderful to work with. It's just, you know, kind of cover some of these basics. But that's the problem. I will propose too on this long tangent. We humans are dopamine fueled machines. We're all dopamine addicts. Dopamine is the neurotransmitter of like motivation and novelty. Like, we get a dopamine hit anytime we do something pleasurable, like eat something delicious or have sex or exercise and go outdoors. Like, all of those things are dopamine hits. We also get dopamine when there's novelty. So if you try something new, that'll be a dopamine hit. We also get dopamine surges when we feel like we're rewarded for something. So that's exactly how smartphones and social media and games are so freaking addictive, is that every time that stupid little game gives you a whole bunch of points, or the little, you know, the fake gambling app tells you that you hit the jackpot or whatever it is, every time it does that, you're getting a dopamine hit. And we start getting really addicted to it and craving it. But if you think, what would be a better dopamine hit that we all deeply crave? Scrolling on social media and then finding a new fancy schmancy supplement that you've never tried before, and like the reviews on the website say that it was amazing and it cured them of all their ailments. Would that be a better dopamine hit? Or just going to bed an hour earlier and doing deep breathing for 5 minutes before you get in bed?
Yeah. Like,
buying the new fancy schmancy supplement and reading all of those exciting reviews, way bigger dopamine hit. It can literally be addicting to buy new supplements and get new lab tests or find another provider to work with or get another course or get another book or get another free downloadable goodie from well-intentioned providers like us. Like, I'm sure we both have downloadable free goodies that you can get on our websites. Yep. But like, you know, is it like you're addicted to that and the dopamine of it all, but you're still avoiding the hard work that you don't want to do, like the sleep and the stress and the nutrition? Or anyway, I think I lost my train of thought, but hopefully that was valuable, even though I lost the conclusion at the end there.
Yeah, well, again, I think it all comes down to making sure you're adequately looking at foundational pieces. That's where I think people get really lost, is they get so deep in the SIBO space where it's like all about clearing and the foods they need to restrict, and like, yeah, it gets really intense, but in hard, and a lot of their time, energy, and resources are on strategies that are specific to those things, that are very SIBO specific, that sometimes they just don't even have the time and energy to focus anywhere else. Or again, like, they don't see the value necessarily of putting more of the time and energy on some of these foundational pieces. But I think what we're saying is you definitely need to be covering the foundational pieces to make any progress in the SIBO space. And investing so much time and energy on clearing and, you know, the restrictive diets usually have little payoff. You're going to get a lot more payoff. Or I would say there's payoff, but usually people go overboard way more than they have to on any of the restrictions that they need to do. And again, we sort of diversify, but clearing, again, there can be value there, but a lot of times people go overboard. So again, like, the amount of time seems to be wasted on some of these strategies when you could really focus on some of these foundational pieces. And I think another good point in this whole conversation that I see people doing, like, from a priority hierarchy standpoint with gut related things, is that they're so focused on the microbiome, or again, like the gut bacteria themselves, the SIBO itself, mm-hmm. that they don't address like digestive and motility breakdowns. Again, like some of these core pieces that it's going to be really hard to balance your microbiome if some of these upstream issues aren't addressed. I feel like there's so much to say there too, where like I think the functional medicine space, even they, I think they do this somewhat, but sometimes they jump straight towards like the microbiome instead of trying to figure out, okay, is there digestive breakdowns that we have to address? Are there motility issues that we have to address? Like some of these things upstream that will just always negatively affect the microbiome. And you're probably better off focusing on those things first too, which is sort of, again, like I think if you have horse blinders on the SIBO, you can miss you can miss, again, like some of these, when you're talking about gut function itself, you can miss some of these really key pieces that actually are very important in determining what is happening in the microbiome. I think sometimes there's like this overzealousness to jump straight towards the microbiome work and balancing that out versus doing some things maybe upstream that would help create a much better environment for the downstream stuff. So I think there's that too, where we might get horse blindery on like the microbiome's it, right? Yep. Versus versus actually seeing like what upstream issues could be leading to some of the microbiome issues. I think that question isn't necessarily asked as much as it should in the functional space, which kind of drives me nuts too.
Yeah. And I think like this kind of comes down to the art of this kind of work, honestly, like as corny as it sounds, like there's the science of nutrition, medicine, healing, all of the things. Like there's an art and a science to both all of these professions, where it's like, okay, you can learn all of the book learning things about nutrition, right? And you can have that knowledge, but then you have to get acquainted with, or you have to gain the skill over time with practice of like designing the program, if you will. Like you could have all the knowledge about nutrition, but if all of those factors are created equal in your brain, you're just as likely to start somebody out on introducing, you know, thiamine rich foods versus just getting them to eat enough calories. So there needs to be a bit of a hierarchy. And similarly in functional medicine, like I've seen it a couple ways, but I think that there is this premise still in functional medicine and naturopathic medicine of like, no matter what, you start with the gut. Right. End of story. No matter what, like, even if you have zero gut problems, always start with the gut. And I don't think that's serving people really well. I do think there are some people who genuinely have decent enough gut health, but they need to work on like sleep or stress or other kind of burden on their body first and foremost before they get into any sort of gut work. Yeah, I don't know, but I do find that oftentimes the first thing that naturopaths and functional doctors do is like they'll cover nutrition, but from a restriction standpoint only. Like, oh, let's do IgG food sensitivity testing and have you cut out all of the bad foods, quote unquote, and they load you up with a crap load of supplements, and then they send you on your way, and they might kind of whisper something about sleep or stress, or they might give you a handout on that topic, but it's rarely covered in a great deal of depth. Another way to kind of think of it, like when I'm kind of building a program for somebody or like a treatment plan, is like the foundational things, you could think of it as like a pyramid, where the foundational parts of the pyramid are really big and broad, and then you get into like the tippity top, which is really tiny. The other way to think of it is like kind of connecting it to all the other things. Like you could draw a line connecting sleep, like crappy sleep, to your hormones, to your gut, to your joints, to your skin. Like sleep can literally affect everything else.
Right.
So it's kind of a wild card. Similarly, if you're not eating enough, that has the potential to affect every single cell in your body. And so you're almost better off addressing those big, big things that have the potential to F up everything else. And it's like you're taking the wild cards out of the deck before you play Uno, right? You have to address the big things that have the potential to muddy up the waters and make data interpretation really difficult. And then you're left with a handful of things that you could work on that might be a little bit more straightforward, as opposed to somebody who's trying to treat the microbiome, but they haven't yet dealt with things like sleep and stress and movement and nutrition. And it's like they're getting mixed results or no results, and like the data doesn't make sense from objective testing, and they're really confused and lost and squirrely feeling because there's like four other huge variables that are affecting everything else in the system, and it's making it super confusing. So I'm going to use this one. I just invented a new way to conceptualize this. Taking the wild cards out of the deck before you play Uno. That's the best way I could describe it, is like take all the wild cards out first. And that way the rest of the journey just makes so much more sense and it's much more linear. But if you're one of those people who's had SIBO for years and years and years, you feel like you've tried all the things, you feel like you've tried all the supplements, and you don't know what to do, and you're just spinning your wheels and scratching your head, go back to those basic things. They're basic right. And foundational for a reason, because they affect everything else. And that's probably what you're running into. It's probably muddying up the waters and making it really confusing and making healing a lot harder because you haven't addressed some of these really basic foundational kind of principles.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I like the muddying of waters sort of example, because if these things aren't addressed, your baseline's just not going to be nearly as good, and it's hard to understand any of the nuancey stuff. Like, you can't even get to the nuancey stuff because, again, everything's confusing and the patterns aren't as clear. So I even say that too, like, sometimes even with testing, like, if I'm talking to someone and there's very obvious things we should work on first based on either previous testing or just the signs and symptoms that they're exhibiting, it's like, I'd much rather focus on these things first. We can always go back to any tests that we want to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think you're right. There's a baseline that you get when you cover these foundational pieces that make it a lot easier to determine what the right mode of action is later. I will also say, too, like, I think in this discussion, it's also important, and I think this is a complex issue, but I feel like it's having the flexibility to basically have an open mind to some of these things as well, because I do think that sometimes when you start saying like, oh, we need to like go back to this trauma you had or this stress management issue you had, sometimes I feel like, you know, the client or patient really wants the fancy stuff, you know, really wants all the bells and whistles, because again, I think it's the mindset of, oh, it must be this, and you can get really locked into it. But I think it's one thing to remember when you're working with a provider. I think it's good to ask questions and to understand like why you're doing certain things. But I also think the more you can trust the provider, like put some trust in the provider and really be able to implement some of the strategies and feel good about them. But I really think there has to be kind of a level of trusting the guidance of the provider with some of these obvious things. Because again, I know you have had patients like this where you're working with someone and it's like, we touch base on a follow-up call and it's like, so have you been working on like breath work before meals or chewing? And it's like, no, not really. But I have been taking these four supplements that you recommended. You know, it's like, I think sometimes, again, people get so into, like what you're saying, the shiny ball syndrome, where it's like, it's about doing the work or something, but or maybe they just underestimate the power of some of these foundational pieces too. But you know, we all have clients too, where it's like, oh, it's just like hard to to get them to move on some of those foundational pieces.
I will share what goes through my brain when that happens. And it does. Please. Like, it happens with every practitioner
on planet
Earth. Like, we have all had people who just don't listen to our great advice for whatever reason. Or they'll, like, take the supplements, but they won't do the stress stuff or the sleep stuff.
Right.
My question internally is always, why are you paying me?
Right.
Why are you here? Like, I don't understand why you're paying me money to be here right now. Because you could Google, you know, herbs for SIBO or, you know, antimicrobials for SIBO. Like, that's what you've been doing this whole time. And that's why you found me. But I always just have this voice in the back of my brain when people don't take it, like, advice like that, or they're quote unquote non-compliant. I always just wonder, like, why are you paying me? Why are we here right now? I don't understand. But I will say too, I will, to kind of get into some of the yuckiness of some of the stuff too, I will propose another reason why people oftentimes shun the foundational stuff and they go for the shiny and, you know, the new supplement, the new test, the new whatever, the new practitioner, whatever it might be. Humans, just as a blanket statement, we don't like being wrong and we don't like admitting that we're wrong. I don't like admitting when I'm wrong. I'm sure you don't. We're all just human. We're all just here together. But sometimes we're wrong, and that's just all there is to it. But it's like, if you followed a particular path for a year or 5 years or 10 years or however long it was, people could be screaming at you that you're wrong, but you might not want to listen because it's like, you've already spent so much time and money and effort going down this path that you're just determined to make it work. And it's kind of like that expression, like, what is it? Something to the effect of, like, don't keep making the same mistake because you've spent a lot of time making it.
Right.
Something like that. Right. And it's like, at some point you need to just abandon ship and go with a different path. But I think we talked about this with the vegan episode, right? Where it's like, if you have built up your identity and your social media and you've been like the vegan girl for 5 years and then you find out information that is compelling and says that the vegan diet is not well suited for you at this time in your life, you're probably going to resist that really hard because changing is so unappealing and admitting you're wrong is so unappealing. We would rather save face than admit that we were wrong. And like, I use the example in the vegan episode with nutrition, with something like nutrition, similarly with low FODMAP, people who have been on low FODMAP forever and they were told that's how you treat IBS. And then they find out, no, it's not really treating much of anything. It's a Band-Aid. It's like saying, not only were you wrong every day for years, you were wrong for every meal of every day for years. Like, three times a day, multiple hours a day, you were wrong for a really long time in a really big way. And that's a tough pill to swallow. So I would say, A, I think like the dopamine thing comes to play and everybody just wants the shiny, the sexy thing. And they don't want, you don't get the dopamine hit by doing the boring, unsexy stuff, for one. Number two, humans just don't like admitting we're wrong. And changing your opinion or changing your mind or changing your path requires that you acknowledge that you were wrong. Could have been with the best of intentions. That doesn't matter. But you have to admit that you were wrong in some way or misguided in some way. The other thing, I'm going to get so much flack for this episode now. I sound so judgy, but I swear I'm not. But the other thing is, I think that we all have a little bit of I am special syndrome. Like I know that sleeping more might help other people, but not me. I have the world's most complicated case of SIBO, and therefore I need the most complicated, expensive protocol, and it all needs to be very SIBO specific because I'm special, and that's what my diagnosis is. That's what my label is. And like, we all get this. We all think, I know that worked for somebody else, but it's not going to work for me. We've all had moments like that. However, that is intrinsically not true 100% of the time. Like, you can still feel special. I believe each and every one of you are special. I'm not saying that you're not special, but like, I do think there's a little bit of I'm special syndrome that I see too, where people, you know, or even like the reason why they work with people like us might be because they're like, oh, some other SIBO expert just won't do. I need the best of the best. I need Amy and Nikki on my case. Like, I've seen people where that was kind of the vibe I got from them, where they were like, nope, I'm not going to any other Joe Schmo. You're my person. And it's like, all right. I don't know. I think that you really just need to manage your stress better and maybe chew your damn food. But yeah, I'll be the one to tell you that finally after all these years. So
right.
It's, again, like, we all get the I'm special syndrome. I'm not balking it. I'm just saying we have to acknowledge the brain lesion if we want to do anything about it. That's all.
Right. Well, it's funny when you were talking about the sleep, you know, I don't need to sleep because I just have that SIBO case that's so bad or whatever. But it's like some people too will be like, oh, the SIBO's affecting my sleep, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's it. That's the one thing. Right. So again, it kind of comes full circle, this whole conversation of like, again, I think it's so tricky because, like what we were saying earlier, there's certainly situations where weird symptoms can be linked to the gut, but you can't be overlooking sort of these obvious foundational elements in looking, going down rabbit holes and connecting dots that don't make as much logical sense as the thing that might be right in front of you. That might take more work and time and energy devoted to it compared to maybe just taking a supplement. So yeah, it's again, it's interesting.
Can I share something that just, I'm chuckling internally and externally because I just thought of this one. All right. Going back to the idea that we all are wrong sometimes and it sucks, but you have to acknowledge that. And going back to the I'm special syndrome. And again, it ties back with the horses, zebras thing from the beginning of the episode. I had low back pain and I tried some of the stuff that's like known for being good for low back pain, right? I went to physical therapy. I got different running shoes. I quit rowing. Well, I mean, I stopped rowing because I was done with my sport in college, but I thought like, oh, rowing is notorious for effing up people's backs.
Right.
So I figured, oh, when I stop rowing, my back pain will get better. I tried massage. I tried doing a little bit of yoga. I tried like cross training and like doing like spin and different kinds of exercise so that I wasn't just doing one repetitive movement all the time. I strengthened my glutes. I strengthened my core. Like, I did all the things I could think of. And then I literally went to chiropractic school because I had low back pain. And it was my Hail Mary. I was like, screw it. Nobody else can figure out why I have low back pain, so I'm going to become a spine expert. I literally spent it when I graduated. This is pre any interest. I spent $185,000 on a degree that I did not need to solve my low back pain. The problem was gluten.
Like, right.
Talk about being wrong and costing a lot of money. Now, granted, I've done things with my license and my profession since then, but like between you and me, I could have gone a different route. I could have gone to naturopathic school. I could have gone nurse practitioner route. I could have gotten to where I am today with any number of other professions and titles and accolades. I did not have to become a chiropractor. But the reason I went to chiropractic school is because I had low back pain and I was determined to fix it. And I pursued this musculoskeletal model of back pain. And I spent $185,000 on this path. And then it turns out, nah, man, it's not structural at all. Your body just hates gluten and you're a celiac. How crazy is that? So I don't care how wrong you've been for how long. I bet you have not spent $185,000 in your wrongness like I have. So I don't want to hear about it, people. Like, you can suck it up and change your path and change your destiny. I don't care where you are in the journey. So at least there's that little glimmer of hope and humor that I could impart on all of you. Because that's ludicrous now that I'm thinking about it.
For sure. For sure. Just a $185,000 mistake.
I'm not even going to tell you how much it is now with interest.
I can't, oh gosh.
I cannot verbalize the number.
Right.
but it's up there.
Oh my gosh. Right.
And that's purely from grad school, by the way. I had no debt from undergrad because I had a rowing scholarship. That's right. All grad school.
Like, yeah.
Bananas. But anyway, there was another kind of part. Now I've bummed Amy out sufficiently. There was another point that I wanted to make, and you kind of lightly touched on this, and I'll put it into words a little bit more, perhaps. You kind of chalked it up to, like, having some trust in the process or trusting the provider a bit, and I will say it goes back to something we've talked about, which is being kind of curious and playful and inquisitive with the treatment. Like, if you go into your treatment, say that you come in and you have SIBO and some associated GI symptoms and a really restricted diet that you would like to broaden out, and you have brain fog and fatigue, I would say, like, start working on the things that become apparent. Like, if we do blood work together and we find you're iron deficient, we're going to work on that. We're going to work on the SIBO, the motility, whatever it is. But, like, be open-minded and playful and curious and inquisitive in the process. And you could be optimistic in the process, too. It's like, I guess the way I would put it is, don't go into the treatment plan being like, if I treat the SIBO, the brain fog and the fatigue will absolutely get better. And if they don't get better, then I'm not treating the SIBO right. But you could go in with the curiosity of, I wonder if I treat the SIBO, if the brain fog and fatigue will get better. And wouldn't that be wonderful if they did? Right? Like, it's like curious and optimistic rather than an expectation that you may or may not achieve. And then it allows you to be flexible. Like, if you go into it with, oh, I'm really curious to see if the brain fog and fatigue get better when we treat the SIBO, say we treat the SIBO and those two things don't go away. If you went into it curious and playful and inquisitive and, like, optimistic, you could pivot and you could say, okay, well, the SIBO is doing a lot better and those symptoms didn't really shift. Therefore, maybe we need to do other things to address those symptoms.
Right.
Instead of getting all, like, freaked out and lost feeling where it's like, I still have brain fog. The SIBO must still be there. Oh my God, I treated the SIBO wrong. I need to do the elemental diet. Oh my God. And you go off a cliff and like lose your mind. You don't have to spiral like that. Just go into it kind of curious and optimistic and like, let's see what happens. And then you can change the plan if you need to change the plan later on.
Yeah, I like that you bring it up as an expectation, because I think when you think about so many symptoms being linked to something like SIBO, so then the expectation is like, SIBO, once that's gone, all of these things are going to be gone.
Farting rainbows and riding like, my unicorn into
my life will be perfect once this SIBO is gone. And again, like, it's just, that can be so devastating too. Like, if you know, you treat the SIBO and you've made progress. And I like how you kind of said there's a curiosity. And I think it's about making sure you're paying attention to progress too. Mm-hmm. Like, again, okay, treating the SIBO helped with these symptoms. But I still have some of this other stuff going on, like what you're saying. I wonder what that could be or what we're missing. And again, being curious about it. But I think you're right. If you have the expectation that once the SIBO is gone, everything's going to be gone, it can set you up to fail pretty miserably, mentally, I think, and physically, too. It can kind of set the wrong expectations for the work.
Can I put a little snark in our bark for a second, too? Like, can I? I'm going to go there.
Sure.
That's a brand new expression I just made up, by the way. Hashtag snark with the bark, or snark in the bark. I forget it now. Anyway, in my opinion, I don't think I've ever seen a person who was like in pristine, perfect health, and then they spontaneously got SIBO.
Right.
Right. Like, and there's some mechanisms that could make some sense. Like, okay, if you took a PPI and gave yourself SIBO with the PPI, you probably had reflux or gastritis or something going on to make you take the PPI. Or with that lady, if she was having difficulty conceiving, presumably something was going on and she was not in pristine, perfect health before getting herself right into the IBS kind of SIBO world. Now, here's the thing. I don't know if pristine, perfect health exists. That's a whole nother like philosophical episode for us to cover because I don't think perfect human health is a thing. But like theoretically, there could be one person out there who genuinely has their stress under control and like, you know, they have great nutrition, everything organic. They don't use anything toxic in their life. They have great relationships with everybody. Just they're farting rainbows and going through their life and it's magical. But I think that it's, I talked about this in a recent YouTube series and Instagram series where it's like, you're throughout your life, you're either inching closer to or inching further away from a metaphorical ditch or cliff edge. And it's like, depending how squirrely and inflamed and dysfunctional you are, the day of whatever the trigger was, that's going to dictate the likelihood of whether or not you develop SIBO. So if you were like in 100% pristine, perfect health, and then you took a PPI for a week for some odd reason, you'd probably be fine. If you were hella inflamed and you took a PPI for a week, you might get SIBO from it. Like, no joke. I've seen that happen with people. If you are in pristine, perfect health, you travel abroad, you get food poisoning, there's less of a likelihood that your immune system is going to go bonkers and start attacking the nerves of your intestines and get that anti-vinculin post-infectious autoimmunity thing going on. But if you're already inflamed and squirrely and you have autoimmune stuff and nutritional deficiencies and your immune system is just a little bit jacked up to begin with, then you get food poisoning, there's that much more likelihood that your immune system is going to lose its mind and start attacking your nerves and give you post-infectious IBS, and then that's going to give you SIBO. Right. And it's like, I forget where I'm going with this exact topic now, but just, it's almost like, again, the blinders. Like, people will hyper-focus on the SIBO or the IBS or the microbiome or the candida or whatever it is. They'll hyper-focus on that. And it's almost like we're telling ourselves, this is the only thing I have to work on because I was in perfect health before I got sick. And it's like, that probably was not true. Right. Like, let's just have a truth moment, people. Right. There was probably stuff you could improve on even prior to getting SIBO. And so the blinder idea is just kind of a joke to begin with because you always had some other stuff that you could work on. I have stuff I could work on, like we all do.
Right.
And giving yourself permission to ignore all that stuff and just look for the fancy zebras and go down like this weird, deep, weird rabbit hole that you're down, it's not serving you well, most likely.
Right.
That's my guess.
Right. I agree.
Well, now that I bummed everybody out with the idea that perfect human health is not something we can obtain, again, that's a philosophical episode for another day. I think we could strive for it, but it's ultimately something that we're not going to like reach.
Right.
We could get closer to the nearest galaxy, right? But like, we're never going to get there in our lifetime, shy of some really revolutionary new technology. Like, we're just not going to get there. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try.
Right.
Or we shouldn't try to get a better picture of that. And we're all living and breathing and we all have stuff that we can improve on, myself included. But yeah, I think I have one more thing on my mind and then we might be wrapping up this horse-themed episode. The internet is very skilled at making you feel doomed. doomed.
Yeah.
We try to be the exception to that rule here on the IBS Freedom Podcast. And I know on Amy's Instagram and my Instagram, we try to be the exception to that. But the internet in general, broadly speaking, is very skilled at making you feel doomed because that's how the internet sells you stuff. And whether it's the Facebook groups, like the SIBO groups, the IBS groups, the Candida groups, the Hashimoto groups, whatever it is, forums and groups and Reddit threads, those all are going to be populated with people who are very sick and very scared and very desperate. And it's going to give you a very skewed echo chamber of people who are spinning their wheels. And it's going to give you this impression that you too are doomed to spin your wheels with SIBO for all of eternity, and there's no hope for you, and this is such a hard thing to treat. And, you know, I've even mentioned to patients before, like, people are surprised to hear this. I don't think SIBO is terribly hard to treat, truthfully. I think, like, it depends on what your root causes are and what all is going on in your life, but I don't find SIBO particularly hard to treat. But it has this reputation for being really hard to treat and being a really chronic condition. And again, I think it's because people are ignoring this unglamorous, unsexy stuff, the foundational stuff that we've been talking about. But if you take no other action from this episode, unfollow all of your Facebook groups. Even some of them would be surprising to you, like mom groups. You would think those are benign. But even mom groups can be really, really toxic and make you feel doomed because they're posting about their health or their kids' health. Unfollow all of your Facebook groups. Take a break from Reddit or, you know, what other forums that you have. Are Yahoo chat rooms still a thing? I don't even know. Like, get off the Yahoo chat rooms. And maybe even go through, like, your Instagram and your YouTube subscriptions and weed out some of the ones that you don't find beneficial anymore. You could always jot down or take a screen capture of the name of the account in case you want to follow it again down the road, but unfollow the people who aren't helping you either mentally or like by giving you new, novel, worthwhile ideas. But I think if we kind of trim back some of the bombardment of information that we have and we just try to focus on sources of information that aren't going to freak us out and make us feel doomed, that alone could be really therapeutic. And you'll probably find that you're less likely to look for the zebras when you hear hooves. Similarly, I always recommend to patients, resist the urge to Google stuff to the best of your ability. We all do it sometimes, but with health stuff, you know, it's the stereotypical, like, I have a bruise on my pinky finger. WebMD. You have leukemia. Oh my God. Like, it's always something terrible if you go on WebMD. And so even just Googling something can be really, really bad for your mental health and make you feel quite doomed. And again, you're going to see this list of like, oh, it could just be dehydration or it could be cancer. And the anxious, traumatized, freaked out, exhausted brain, especially, is going to gravitate to the scary things. You're going to ignore all of the boring things like dehydration, not enough sleep. You're going to ignore all that stuff on the list, and you're going to hone in right on, oh, it's cancer. I'm dying. I'm dying right now. Oh my God. And nobody needs that in their life. Like, it is terrifying. Find sources of information you trust. If you have the ability to work with a practitioner or a nutritionist or a dietitian, find somebody that you trust who's not going to terrify you on a regular basis and like trigger this in you, and relinquish that control to somebody else if you can, so that you don't have to be perpetually Googling things and looking on forums and stressing yourself the F out. So that's my big takeaway from horse episode part two for you.
Yeah, I think, again, it goes back to we have a negativity bias as humans, so we're going to probably be more drawn to, like, what could go terribly wrong instead of maybe, again, like, the obvious things. But I will say, if you are looking for some positive accounts to follow on social media, I would highly recommend Boston Terrier Photography. So I, like, pulled up my phone. The first post... That's like the only post that come up on my Facebook feed now. I think my algorithm's squared away. But someone posted their Boston Terrier in their husband's pant leg. Like, he went into the pant leg. And it said, "This is Whiskey, my almost 14-year-old old boy. He was cold Thanksgiving morning, so he improvised the husband's pant leg." So, like, there's stuff like that all the time. Oh. It's so cute. There's, like...
That's adorable.
There's siblings, like, they always post, like, Boston Terrier siblings. But yeah, it's, like, just tons of cute stuff. I highly recommend Boston Terrier Photography.
I love that, too. Now, okay, hold on. Now I need to find some that I like. I'll pull up Instagram.
There was one from Boston Terrier Photography, too. I was laughing earlier today. It was, like, a, you know, a 4-year-old Boston... They just got a puppy. And so, like, it kept showing, like, this Boston kind of with grumpy face and the puppy, like, on its head, like, bouncing around him. And it's like, Mom, I know I said I wanted a brother, but now I'm not so sure. Because the dog was just going crazy, the puppy around him. It was so cute.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Here's one. So this is on Instagram. I don't know if she's on Facebook also. Going back, actually, to the negativity bias idea. The account is called Subpar Parks. Have I told you about this one, Amy, or are you familiar? It's fantastic. It is.
You told me about it. It actually popped up on my feed recently.
So it's art. Like, she draws pictures of national parks and state parks, but then she superimposes it with snippets from one-star Google reviews. So this one, for example, only saw one humpback.
Right.
You ungrateful son of a gun. Like, really? Barren wasteland of tundra. Like, and all of these pictures are beautiful.
Right.
Mysteriously silent and lonely.
Oh,
these
my
are
gosh.
All, honest to goodness, one-star Google reviews that people took the time and energy to make one-star Google reviews for these beautiful parks. And then she turned it into this fantastic thing. But again, like, the negativity bias is so real, but I love looking at those because A, it's hilarious. B, it reminds me that no matter how perfect and amazing I am, I will never be everybody's cup of tea.
Right.
And that's okay. Here's a good one. Okay, so this is on Instagram too. The Tortoise Whisperer. Have I told you about this one? Okay, it's fabulous. No. Hold on. Look, this is, the whole episode is just derailing. Okay. I think I should have it on mute. So he has just all these tortoises.
Aww.
And he takes videos of the tortoises. Like, those are the babies. He has a whole bunch of babies. And then he has, I think, 13 full-grown tortoises. But hold on. So there's three of them at the top of their burrow. He's going to go feed them cactus leaves. And then watch, they're like, run away!
Oh my gosh.
And they went to the burrow to get away from him. And then most of his videos are just him, like, feeding the tortoise a piece of cactus. And they're chomping away the cactus.
Kind of reminds me of there's a TikTok account called the Mommy Farmer or something. Mommy Farmer.
Okay.
And, like, there was a whole series on there that I was addicted to because they had goats that had babies, and one was like a total runt. Like, she didn't know that she was gonna make it, and her name was Ruthie, this little goat. And they would have to, like, feed her milk, and the mom kind of wasn't accepting her because she was kind of the runt and was trying to divest energy into the two healthy goats. But Ruthie was so cute. Like, her legs would wobble. She couldn't stand up. Like, her little brother and sister, whatever, could, like, hop around, and she'd try, but, like, flail around, essentially. But yeah, Mommy Farmer, she just goes around and feeds her farm animals and then talks to them really funny. So she's always behave yourself, and, you know, talking to pigs and stuff. She's like, you got out, and she's really funny. They have some really cute corgis too on her feed.
Oh, they're little fluffy butts. I have one more to share. I have to check out Mommy Farmer now though. See, this is the kind of stuff that social media and the internet was made for. Everybody knows this. The internet was made so that we could share pictures and videos of cats. It has no other purpose for humankind. We just need to share cat videos and cat memes. That's it. But if you want to do something else with the internet, this is Nathan Pyle Strange Planet. It's the alien guys.
Yeah.
Oh my God, people. If you haven't discovered this account, what are you waiting for? a lot of them are the alien guys, but then sometimes he has other cartoons that he's drawn. But those bring me a very large amount of joy also.
Nice. So
fill your Instagram and your Facebook feed and your YouTube feed. Fill it with things that bring you joy, not things that make you paranoid and anxious and feeling doomed. And get outside, get your eyeballs off the phone and off the computer. And with that, I think that's the perfect way for me to wrap up this episode. Get out of here. Don't watch us anymore. Go live your life. Get some sun. tone your vagus nerve, walk in the park or something, and we will see you right back here on the next episode of the IBS Freedom Podcast. Do move.